We're in the beginning of President Donald Trump's first 100 days of his second term. What decisions and actions has he taken so far on healthcare, and what effect are they having?
Again, it's a new world. Trump wants to have, a former Democrat who doesn't like vaccines run HHS.
We're talking to the reporters in the nation's capital who are covering the Trump administration as it says it wants to, quote, make America healthy again. Our guests are Shannon Firth with MedPage Today, Michael McAuliffe with Modern Healthcare, and Sarah Overmall with STAT.
Some of these are going to be easier to get than others, but it really shows the mindset that they're going in on. We need to look at aggressive cost cuts, and we're putting every option on the table to start.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, let me welcome all of you to Conversations on Healthcare. And let's start with asking Sarah about the actions President Trump took upon resuming office. He's withdrawn the United States from the World Health Organization. He's also signed other executive orders affecting healthcare. I'm wondering if you could give us an overview, Sarah.
Right. So definitely the big news was his intent to withdraw from the World Health Organization. The WHO has said that they hope he'll reconsider that. There's questions about how quickly that could happen. It's never happened before. There's, in fact, not even a process within the WHO to withdraw your membership. So we're going to see this happen in real time, what that looks like. Then, of course, he rescinded more than 70 other executive orders from President Biden across a range of things. Some of them include, requiring people to go back to the office to work, which, of course, will affect healthcare agencies and plenty of others. Then there were several that had to do with the Affordable Care Act, with expanding the enrollment period, with certain provisions that Biden had ordered to experiment on lowering the cost of drugs in Medicare and Medicaid. And then several things having to do with gender affirming care, or really discriminations against people on the basis of sex and gender. I'll say that while there was a litany of these orders, much like when Biden issued those orders, that's just the start of the process. We'll still have to see what that looks like and how agencies are going to carry out those missions that he's given them. We could see legal challenges. Also, some of these things are tied to laws, so it's not so easy as saying, okay, now pull back this program, reverse this process.
Well, Shannon, maybe somewhat of a general question and then on to a specific. When we talk about public health, what are the hopes and fears that you might be hearing from some parts of Congress about the new administration? I think the hopes and fears are probably both important to think about. And maybe on a specific level, a program like Vaccines for Children, not known by that name, probably by lots of people in the United States, but massively important if you're talking about pediatric health and primary care. What does the future hold for a program like that?
Thank you, Margaret. So thank you, first of all, for having me on the show. When we talk about public health, there's a lot of concerns right now among physicians, public health experts, researchers about the future of public health under this new administration. There's a lot of concern about Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's been nominated as Trump's health secretary. There's petitions. There's one petition with over 20,000 signatures of physicians. My colleague Joyce Frieden wrote a story about that. There's also a competing petition from the Make America Healthy Again group, and that has about 800 physicians who are in support of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. becoming HHS secretary. So one of the big concerns, obviously, around Kennedy, as most people know in the health space, is that he was the founder of the Children's Health Defense, which is an anti-vaccine group. He said that there is no safe and effective vaccine. And where that becomes very concerning is as HHS secretary, he would have oversight of the CDC, the FDA, HHS, CMS, and CDC, and FDA in particular. CDC has an advisory body that recommends a schedule for vaccines, who should take which vaccine at what age, and what populations should be, prioritize for that. And then in terms of approvals, the FDA has its own advisory committee. So there's concerns that there could be changes to those committees. There's also, as you mentioned, the Vaccines for Children's program that provides free access to free vaccines for underinsured and uninsured children across the country. So more than 50% of the children in the U.S. are eligible for vaccines through the program. That includes children on Medicaid, that includes children in the Indian Health Services. There's, you know, 19 disease-specific vaccines that they can get. And it's really, I think, important. Public health experts say it's really important that that program continues. So in each of these cases, there's concern that there could be changes to either these independent committees who are advising and approving vaccines, or there could be potentially changes in funding. I spoke with, potentially changes in funding for the vaccines program. I spoke with Larry Bichon last week, who's a former congressman. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon, and he's a Republican, and he said that he was reassured. He felt that Congress would defend the program against any sort of attack like this that could happen in terms of funding. So he's not concerned. Representative Schreier, Kim Schreier, who's a pediatrician from Washington, she's been really intent on expanding the Vaccines for Children program, and she is concerned. She said that between stated intents to cut both Medicaid and cut funding for CDC, she worries that this program could be caught in the crossfire. She did say, however, that she believes that her Republican colleagues, she hopes that her Republican colleagues will follow the science and, quote, look at the track record of this excellent program and work in a bipartisan fashion to ensure that it continues. So I think
That's great. Let me pick up on the theme of potential changes, and maybe a question to all of you. The Ways and Means Committee has a proposed list of changes in the tax bill. Front and center was health. I note a couple of things that might pose a little controversy, that elimination of the nonprofit status for hospitals, and of course, certainly the FMAP program. Any thoughts as you sort of looked at that document, and it covers sort of a wide range of potential dramatic cuts in the healthcare arena?
Well, I mean, when I looked at that, I mean, first, I think it actually comes from the Budget Committee. It just happens to be that Ways and Means was the first committee mentioned, right? Everybody's in there. And Jody Arrington, the chair of the Budget Committee, sort of in charge of quarterbacking that. But my initial read of that, and from some conversation with some of the lawmakers who are, you know, going to be considering these things, is that it really is a menu. It is not even a wish list. For some people, it's a wish list. But for most of Congress, it's like, here are all the things where we have some kind of score where we can say, OK, if we go ho hog on this, it's going to save $146 billion by doing a really robust site neutral plan for hospitals, right? That's, you know, $900 billion if we want to really block grant in the most aggressive way, the Medicaid program, right? So that's really what I think that is. And as they start to talk amongst themselves and in among the committees, then they're going to have to start winnowing down what they actually want. And if you really read that document, and it is hard going, when you get to the Energy and Commerce Committee, which is, you know, one of the most important committees for all of this, you see a lot of things in there like, well, the Energy and Commerce Committee did not provide details on this proposal. So just you don't usually dime out your colleagues in the document that you're circulating amongst all the other lawmakers to try and come to some sort of consensus. So it suggests just even in the form of the thing that there is a long way to go before lawmakers settle in on what they actually want to do.
Michael, I thought it was an advertisement for lobbying firms to make sure you had enough.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? Everybody's got something in there. So everybody's going to be diving in to say, hey, wait a second, not us.
I completely agree with the way that Michael characterized it as looking at it like a menu, as sort of a starting block to the levers that they could potentially pull. And like you both said, you know, then the lobbying really starts. And so I don't think that we'll see necessarily hospitals take the hits that they are projecting here. And like Michael said, there was a funny lack of ownership when we all saw that document of like who wrote this, who's backing this. So you need that first. You need the champions for those things. Some of these are going to be easier to get than others, but it really shows the mindset that they're going in on. We need to look at aggressive cost cuts, and we're putting every option on the table to start.
Well, we heard a good bit during the campaign about the future of subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, still known to most people, I think, in America as Obamacare. And I think it was assumed that Republicans would not want to extend them. But Michael, you've reported that maybe there is support and those subsidies are not doomed after all in the new administration. Why is that? And why might they be perceived as something that really has to be kept?
Well, it's sort of, you see it in that big document we were just talking about. There's a lot of conflicting sort of imperatives and needs that the folks in Congress are wrestling with. And while you may have a historic ideological opposition to Obamacare, especially if you call it Obamacare rather than the ACA, that has benefited red states in particular, especially rural people and poor populations, disproportionately. So those states would really suffer. And you do have a fair number of medical practitioners in Congress, guys like Greg Murphy or the pharmacist, Buddy Carter, who's now chairing the Health Subcommittee of ENC. And those folks actually know what it means when you take away that amount of money from their system. Doesn't mean they don't want to do it, but they want to figure out, okay, how can I, you know, save maybe some of this so that we're not completely creamed? And that whole, you know, barometer of, you know, where do you cut, where do you save is really going to be very hard for the Republican Party. And that's going to be true for subsidies, for Medicaid reforms, for site neutral laws. You know, just about anything has a plus and a minus. And if you're in power, it means you have constituents, businesses and regular people who will suffer one way or the other if you actually go through with a cut. So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons they want to do these things quickly, because it takes a little bit of time for understanding and pushback to come that doom these things. And then you have a Congress that's, you know, they have 218 Republicans right now, 215 Democrats. You need a majority to pass something. So if you lose one, you're doomed.
Mm-hmm. You know, Sarah, so let me pull the thread on.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And some of those things that you might think would be doomed, if they actually help their districts, might not be.
Right.
Sarah, Obamacare, or as Michael said, ACA, faces some other threats. And you've written about the Supreme Court's upcoming decision regarding access to preventative health services with no out-of-pocket cost. Tell us what's at stake here.
Right. So the Braidwood case, the Supreme Court has agreed to hear arguments on that. So that could come up in the next few months with a decision expected by July. And what's significant about that case is it's the first one you've seen for a little bit to come before the court that is essentially an attack on a form of protection or expansion that ACA gave to covering certain preventive care at no cost. So in this case, really what the Supreme Court's going to be hearing about is this one panel of advisors in particular, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, and what they recommend or require insurers to cover for people at no cost. The main target from the plaintiffs is PrEP, the medicine that prevents HIV transmission, but PrEP is not one of the only, by far, one of the only things that the Preventive Services Task Force requires coverage of. It's cancer screenings, mammograms, certain other, you know, preventive services. What is going to be significant about this is if the court does decide that, we could see insurers decide that they may not cover these medicines and services, or more likely will cover them at a certain cost to that patient. So that could have, particularly for PrEP, significant impact for certain patients. Another aspect of Braidwood that the Supreme Court won't be hearing this time around, but that is still floating around, is that the plaintiffs originally also wanted to question the authority of two other expert panels at HHS. One of them, ACIP, which covers vaccines and requires coverage of immunizations. And one of them is essentially women's health, birth control, family planning, which is covered under part of HHS called HRSA. For now, ACIP and HRSA are not part of this particular arguments, but we could see a question of their authority. And if they're allowed to do that, which again is also protected by ACA, it's going to matter, I think, what Trump's future health officials, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr., would decide to do when staffing these panels, or what kind of authority they would allow them to have in the future as well.
Well, it's going to be particularly interesting because, if I'm correct, I think the Congressional Budget Office had to score all those things, and the sciences or the economic data is pretty overwhelming that they save money in the long run. So it'll be interesting to see what the people in charge of cost cutting are going to do about that. And I guess along those lines, Michael, you wrote an interesting piece about the Republican leaders in Congress and their role relating to health issues. And you all called out a couple of names, but who are the Republican leaders that are really front and center on the health issues? And are they all in lockstep with the president on his goals?
No, I don't think they are in lockstep with the president on his goals. I think they are just sort of sentimentally and psychologically. But as I was saying before, like when you start getting down to brass tacks and it starts affecting your district or your campaign donors, you know, then all of a sudden you start having a slightly different take on things. And we're in a really interesting time. You know, after they passed the ACA, right, there was it was really partisan in healthcare, and it's become less so. Mm-hmm. So now you've got it's not Greg Murphy, Brett Guthrie from Kentucky taking the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee. He had been the Health Subcommittee chair, and the ACA is very popular in Kentucky, right? You know, when they tried to repeal it in 2017, that was when Mitch McConnell was in real trouble. And in some ways, he got saved by John McCain, you know, killing the repeal. So he's aware of that. He knows that. And he ran a business before. He was part of family business before he came to Congress. So he has a pretty wonky almost understanding of how the healthcare system works. So he's not going to go charging right ahead. And in that document we were talking about before, they have things that will cost money that are on the list for, you know, potentially getting selected for reconciliation. So there is definitely a more nuanced understanding of how the healthcare system works on the Energy and Commerce Committee. But if you go over to Ed and Workforce, which has, you know, association plans and all the other sorts of things that go with the employer world, there they seem a little bit more ideological. And the new chairman, Tim Walz, is a he wants to charge ahead and go with anything that reduces these costs. So I think they're more ideological there, and I think they will try and push more cuts to the ACA and things like that, just because of they don't have the sort of, you know, the hospitals and the doctors lobbying them quite the way Energy and Commerce does. And then over in the Senate, you've got Bill Cassidy, who is a doctor, and has quite a deep understanding of how all these things work. He's a true wonk. He likes to do requests for information on you name it, and he's probably done it. He already started doing it before he got the chairmanship this year. And then over on Senate Finance, which has all of those big health programs that the federal government runs, you have Mike Crapo, who's sort of a traditional, very staid Republican, very in the old sort of pro-business, you know, be slow and calm kind of rule of doing things. So I don't think you're going to see either of those guys rushing to do some of these huge cuts that we're talking about. I think it's going to be much more like the sort of traditional, we want to pare back and have, you know, eligibility standards, and we want to root out fraud and abuse, and we want to let the private sector do its thing. And it'll be more like that from those guys. But, you know, again, it's a new world. Trump wants to have, you know, a former Democrat who doesn't like vaccines run HHS. And I'm really interested to see how much those guys in particular sort of go along with the more sort of MAGA Trumpian sort of line. I don't know that they will, but I also don't know that they won't, right? They haven't really tipped their hand too hard one way or the other, although Cassidy doesn't sound like he's too happy about the vaccine sentiments of Mr. Kennedy. Beyond that, we'll have to see.
Sarah, thinking about where the money is in healthcare, certainly Medicare and Medicaid are the two big ones. We noticed that President Trump promised not to cut Medicare during the campaign, but didn't say a lot about Medicaid, which has many more enrollees than Medicare does. STAT has been researching what Medicaid looks like in that second Trump presidency. Maybe talk a little bit about what your findings have been.
Right. So, well, as both Shannon and Michael have alluded to, there have already been these discussions on the Hill, certainly, about what it looks like to reform Medicaid and potentially get savings from it. A lot of what we know about what Trump would do comes from his first administration and what efforts were made during by officials at Medicare and Medicaid during that time. So we know, for instance, that block grants are something that has been floated, and you know, that would essentially be flat spending from the federal level, more responsibility onto the state programs for their funding, and potentially cost caps, spending caps, and then another thing that was popular in the first Trump administration that we are already seeing returning on the state level to a certain degree is the idea of work requirements. So people who are able to work having some sort of requirement to hit a certain number of hours a week in order to have Medicaid coverage. We've seen even in this past election, at least one state passed a referendum that could implement that. We saw during the first Trump administration that Medicare issued waivers to several states to allow those programs. The Biden administration revoked that, but we could really, I would expect to see a version of that back again. We also know that, you know, there's discussions of changing the benefits and what that could mean for, you know, the CHIP program as well, the program for children's health insurance. So I think there's a lot that's going to be on the table. And the fact that President Trump has been so explicit that Medicare will not be touched, but not said the word Medicaid necessarily, is leaving that door open.
What about the governors in those red states, the impact that Medicaid might, reductions or paring back on Medicaid might have?
Well, I mean, like the other panelists were discussing, this is going to be really, really politically tricky, because if you're going to be paring back Medicaid at the same time that the federal government is discussing changing or eliminating the subsidies for the ACA, then you're going to have a lot of people starting to fall through the cracks. And in these particular states, in these red states where there hasn't been great coverage or there has been a heavy reliance on subsidies and on Medicaid expansion. So I think what we're going to see when it comes down to it is that some of these governors in these states will see that this is not a very good bargain for them. And some of the Congress people who represent those states will see that if they have to go home and sell that they voted on things like this, what is that going to look like? And, you know, if their voters see their coverage change or that they lose it, that's going to be something that will hit them in the next election.
Michael, President Trump has nominated former TV host Dr. Oz to lead the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. How do you think his nomination looks, and what kind of vision he'll bring to the position if he has it?
Well, I've actually been trying to hunt around on that, and I honestly haven't found all that much. So I'm sort of reading a little bit between the tea leaves. I think they're looking at Kennedy first and seeing if they can get him through. And he's running into some problems. Certainly all the Democrats aren't too crazy about him. Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins on the Republican side aren't that crazy about him. Cassidy doesn't seem to be committed to him. And then there are some folks who are worried about his purity on the sort of pro-life issue. So that seems to be taking up a lot of their attention. And then on Oz himself, he seemed, I think it was Stat who had some good reporting on who is would be coming in as his team over there. So they seem to be bringing in some sort of older hands who have a good handle on how CMS works. And the big questions that have been raised about him so far have been about conflicts of interest and a little bit about some of the cures and TV, you know, endeavors he's done to sell sort of shady products and things like that. But I have not heard Republicans getting too worried by that. They seem more interested in supporting Donald Trump in his nominees than raising sort of those conflict of interest and product questions. So I think he's on relatively firm ground. But again, that'll become clearer probably after we see if Kennedy's going to go anywhere.
Yeah. Shannon, Congress passed what's called a skinny budget at the end of the year, and many have missed the part of it that Congress did not include a fix to the Medicare doctor pay. What's the problem here, and what happens next?
Thank you. So There was a bill. There was an initial agreement, as we all know, that had a lot more healthcare provisions in it. And one of those provisions would have not eliminated the cuts for physicians, but basically made it a lot easier. The Medicare has been cut. Medicare physician reimbursement has been cut the last 2 years, 1.7% last year and 2.83% this year was what ended up happening in the bill that passed after some interference from people like Elon Musk and President Trump coming in and saying the original bill was not up to par with what they wanted to see. The challenge is physicians, particularly the AMA, the American Medical Association, has spoken very strongly about the fact that physician pay has not kept pace with practice costs. So reimbursement, they'd like to see reimbursement tied to inflation. And a lot of physicians are saying that if pay doesn't catch up, they are going to be forced to either not take Medicare patients or even some may close their practices. The Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, MedPAC, has weighed in on this, and they also feel that physician pay, this is a problem. I mean, this could be a problem for access for patients in the future if physicians start either not taking Medicare patients or closing down their practice because they just can't afford to keep up with the rising costs of care.
Well, a question to Michael and Shannon in our last couple of minutes with you. We heard a lot about the end of Roe versus Wade, of course, during the past 2 years. Is abortion a settled issue now at the federal level, or is there more that you think will or could happen on the subject in this administration?
Well, I think the Trump administration will go back to all the positions that it had the first time around. And I think we saw some of the executive orders already coming out to that effect. But, you know, it's going to be a lot, I think, in the legal space. And I'm not really an expert in it, but you know, that those lawsuits will continue. The states doing their thing will continue. And then you had this sort of weird, almost wild card come in there at the end of Biden's presidency, where he published the Equal Rights Amendment, mm-hmm. Which, you know, there's some legal disagreement about how binding it is. But I think technically it's should be considered part of the Constitution. And I think there will be people who want to test whether it is, and they will probably do it with sort of some of the reproductive rights questions and other questions about equity for women that in theory could be considered guaranteed in the Constitution now. And I really don't know how that will play out, but I saw that happen and I thought, that could be very interesting. I wish I were more of a legal scholar.
I'm also not a legal scholar, but I've been trying to gauge from the experts what they think will happen. And of course, as Michael said, this is definitely not a settled issue at the federal level. We saw two cases last year on abortion. We saw the Supreme Court kind of punted in both cases.
Let me ask one final question to all three of you. What's the biggest healthcare policy issue? And you're going to have so much to write about this year that's on your radar that hasn't bubbled up yet, but you think will be one that arises up in 2025. Michael?
Well, you know, it's funny. It was starting to bubble up last year, but I think the whole question about 340B mm-hmm. is going to become a hotter issue just because, and PBMs, again, they're related, and the pharmacy industry seems to be lobbying quite hard on those issues. And I'm sure they would dearly love to get some restrictions and greater clarity on how all that is supposed to work. So I think that might be one place to look.
Sarah?
There's two, if I can quickly do it. I think things that, while they haven't maybe bubbled up as much, they are on people's radars a bit. One would be the extent to which Trump wants to take down Biden's healthcare legacy, even on things that are fairly popular, like the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, pandemic preparedness that doesn't have to do with COVID-19, and all the mental health care resources and legislation and funding that went out. So that's, that would be one thing, is just kind of the extent of Biden's legacy. The other thing also started to come up towards the end of last year and towards the end of the election, but we didn't really see it get fleshed out there. We just saw the recognition that this was a problem, and that would be long-term care and caregiver support. We do know that we have a rapidly aging population, and that there's many voters who are already caregivers or expecting to be caregivers. Trump did suggest that he would subsidize or fund some sort of caregiver support, but has not talked about that since then. And so I think that's going to be a really big issue, especially for senior voters.
And Shannon?
I would say Medicare Advantage. Basically, there was a lot of interest in prior authorization and denials there under the Biden administration. It's kind of remains to be seen whether that interest will continue, whether there'll be more scrutiny, more oversight in terms of reining in some of the complaints that we've seen around Medicare Advantage. And I think that will be a big issue. I also agree that PBMs, what happens to pharmacy benefit managers, whether Congress tries to rein them in terms of their activity, which has been seen unfairly raising drug prices. We'll see what happens there as well.
Well, it is guaranteed to be an interesting year. Thank you for joining us, Shannon Firth with MedPage Today, Michael McAuliffe with Modern Healthcare, and Sarah Overmall with STAT. And thank you to our audience for being here. And just a reminder, subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Take care. Be well. Thank you so much to our guests. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.